Wasa Iati. Hello, how are you? Chataya Yeshblak you chatuasak. I'm Raven's sister, also known as Mia Wiederspoon. I am from the Stachin Kwan. This year, I have been working as a Living Heritage Research and Communications intern with the Sitka Conservation Society. And as I usually do, I have been working closely with my teacher, Virginia Oliver, Juan Lane. Today I want to tell a story of a residential school on the small island of Wrangell, Alaska, called the Institute. The Bureau of Indian Affairs closed the Wrangell Institute in June of 1975, partially due to the Molly Hooch case. The lawsuit settlement forced the state to build schools and villages with 8 students or more, decreasing the demand for boarding schools. Even though it's been 47 years since the school closed, the effects and stories of the school are still fresh in the memory of those who attended and the community of Wrangell. I had a spark of interest to start researching the Institute's history after hearing some stories of abuse from Jim LaBelle at the Sharing Our Knowledge conference, and also hearing Virginia speak about it during class here and there. To start off, I will quote the Wrangell Sentinel, A and B edition, from November 13, 1935, titled The Beginning of the Institute. It was in the early 1920s that the Alaska Native Brotherhood began work on securing a school such as the Wrangell Institute in southeast Alaska for their people. At their convention in one of those years, the need for the school was brought up, and each year afterwards until little action was finally secured from Washington. Through the A&B representative in Washington, a promise was received from a congressman that he would sponsor a bill of $500,000 to build a school in Alaska for the Indian folk. With lots more organizing and aid from the Chamber of Commerce, congressmen approved the project. Continuing on, still referencing the Wrangell Sentinel, in the spring of 1931, actual work started on the construction of the Institute. Contract was let for clearing the land. After that, contracts were let for the construction of the school building and 2 dormitories. Later, still in the late fall, the staff house was constructed in the early spring of 1932, and the health center was built. On October 4, 1932, the doors opened for the first time to admit students. Fred Johnson of Deweyville was the first student to register at the Wrangell Institute. The first year, 73 students attended the school. Leroy F. Jackson was the director for the first 2 years. Now I want to talk a little bit about student life at the Institute, and I'm still referencing the Wrangell Sentinel here. The heading is Institute vs. Town Team. Tonight at 7 o'clock, the Institute plays their first game of the present basketball season against a team they have never played against before, the Wrangell Town Team. In their last practice, the Institute boys showed speedy floor work, and their scoring was much improved from previous practices. The starting lineup announced by Coach Mize as it follows: Morris Grant, center; Lewis Austin and Lincoln Paradovich, forwards; and Clarence Anisket and George Gunya, guards. All right, moving on. This article clipping is from Tundra Times, dating December 3rd, 1962. It's headed, World News. Wrangell Eagle, student paper published at the Wrangell Institute, elementary grade school for Native children, covered the world news in a recent issue. Bylined by Johnny Nakota, the headline read, U.S. and Russia disagrees over arms in Cuba. Okay, moving on. Now I'm going to reference a blurb from the Aleut Relocation book. Wrangell Institute students study the natural life of the sea and shore, the village communities and their economic health problems, business accounting and homemaking. In addition, their contributory skills are taught: woodworking, building construction, boat building, blacksmithing, and machine shop practice, engine installation, operation and repair, navigation, and the household arts. The students also assume responsibility and cooperate with the staff members and assemblies. Control of health and sanitation, upkeep of the lighting and heat facilities, student accounts, and athletics. Now I would like to switch to a student's perspective. I will now read Jim LaBelle's testimony. Jim LaBelle is a boarding school survivor. Jim LaBelle is also a huge part of the Truth and Healing Commission on Indian Boarding School Policies Act. This was written May 12, 2022. My name is Jim LaBelle Sr. My family originated in Kotzebue, Alaska. I was born and raised in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm a member of the native village of Port Graham and a shareholder in the Chugiak Alaska Corporation. I'm a Vietnam veteran of the United States Navy and have been married for 50 years to my wife, Susan. We have 3 children and 7 grandchildren. I have been waiting to tell this story my entire life. I come to you as an assimilated man, as an acculturated man. While I received an education and met all the economic standards of your culture, I lost my family, I cannot speak my language, and I cannot do the traditional fishing and gathering I learned as a child. I was born to a white father and a Nupiaq mother. My mother's people came from the Arctic Circle on the Bering Sea. My parents met in Nome, Alaska, and were married in Fairbanks, where I was born. Before I went to school, I was bilingual and spoke both Inupiaq and English. My dad died at the very young age of 41 from cancer when I was 6 years old. My mother sent us to boarding school, thinking that we would at least be together in the summertime. That plan did work out for a few years, but 1 year I was met by strangers at the airport who said they would be our foster parents for the summer. I became an unpaid worker on a Fairbanks farm called Kramer's Dairy, where I was basically an indentured servant on that farm. I have recently come to learn that this was an outing program, which was a common practice for the government to send out boarding school students as unpaid laborers during the summer months. I was a product of two BIA boarding schools from 1955 to 1965. The first 6 years I was at the Wrangell Institute in Wrangell, Alaska. We were sent to Wrangell by plane. When they first took me to the airport, I was looked on with a roster. They saw my name and immediately tied me together with other children with pieces of rope. They fixed a yellow name tag on our clothing, and on that name tag there was our name, our destination, and our flight information. Speaking English was a commodity. I could see fright in the faces of children who could not speak English. Some children would curl themselves up in a ball and close their eyes and rock back and forth. Others would close their eyes and try to blink you out like toddlers would, not wanting to believe where they were. Most of us had never ridden on airplanes before, only increasing the terror. In Anchorage, we were met with even more children coming from all over. It was like an annual migration. Every fall, there would be these hordes of native children coming from all over Alaska into these hubs like Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage. At Juneau, we were placed on PBY planes, which are amphibious. We took off from the water, which again added to the terror. The entire trip was overall a 2-day ordeal. When we arrived at Wrangell, we were bused to the Institute and the tempo began to change. There was an angry urgency in the matron's voice. The school, like other governmental institutions, had massive signs that said, "United States property, keep out." It was very imposing. We were taken into an open area and divided by gender. We were stripped totally naked, our hair was cut, and we marched into the shower. Many of my classmates had never seen running water before, and they were frightened by the showers. One boy was hesitant to scrub his body, so a matron scrubbed his skin until he bled. It sent a message to the rest of us. That first night in our barracks, and for many nights after, we called out for our mothers and cried ourselves to sleep. Each of us was given a 2-digit number marked on our government-issued clothing, which corresponded with our names. If you forgot your number, you were spanked. Many children had difficult names to begin with, so matrons found it easier to simply refer to them by number. The children who could not speak English did not know how to follow the rules, and every time they opened their mouths, they spoke their own language. They constantly were beat. Those who spoke their language were placed on a high stool and given dunce caps. We unwittingly became part of the process of helping our classmates assimilate. We were used to eating traditional foods such as moose, caribou, salmon, reindeer, berries, and grains. Now we were forced to eat industrial foods in 1-pound cans. We had severe stomach issues, diarrhea, vomiting, sometimes all at once. We soiled our pants and our beds, and the matrons would force us to clean our own mess. For those that were deemed uncompliant for speaking their own language, they had to run the gauntlet. It became a spectator sport. Little 5- and 6-year-olds had to disrobe in front of other children who were ordered to hit those running the gauntlet with belts as hard as they could, otherwise they were next. When I was forced to run down the line, it was never a single run, it was often 2 or 3 times. The most violent thing that will forever be sealed in my memory is when I was 10 years old, I was punished for horseplaying with a friend by a matron. He forced us into an open shower, unclothed and naked, as he shielded the open door with his body. He reached in the back and pulled out a fire hose. He turned the fire hose on me and my friend. The fire hose came from a water reservoir on the top of the mountain above the school, which was always caked with ice and snow. I can still remember the incredible pain and shock of not being able to breathe from the force of the fire hose. My friend had an ear infection and icy water was getting into his infected ear, he screamed louder than I did. I witnessed the same matron punch another friend of mine so hard that he splayed my friend's cheek open all the way up to his ear, and half of his face fell open. He was immediately unconscious and came back from the hospital with his mouth wide shut. He could only drink through a straw. This violence became a daily reminder of the matron's enjoyment of inflicting pain on children. Today we call them sadists. There was also sexual abuse. These schools were magnets for pedophiles. At lights out, the matrons would start molesting the youngest children in the lower bunks and bathrooms. There were two or three matrons on duty, and we were an open field of candidates they could abuse at their whim. As these children reached their early teens, many of them began molesting the younger children as well. So began the cycle of sexual abuse in the school. In the girls' dorm, I can still remember girls going home as young as 11 years old, and they were pregnant. One girl told me she was a favorite of an administrator, and he would call her down from class and molest her every single day in his office. She admitted to me that she cut herself to relieve the pain and maybe had more than one personality. She passed away a few years ago now, and I still think she is in a better place. On our first summer returning home, my younger brother Kermit and I were eager to see our family again. Yet, because of how long we had been away, he asked, "I wonder if our mother will still remember us." During our 10 years in the boarding school, we indeed became estranged from our mother. We lost our ability to speak our language and do traditional fishing, hunting, and gathering. At the end of the 10 years, I did not know who I was as a native person. I didn't know who I was because they never told us who we were. I learned American history, world history, math, science, and English, but I never knew who I was as an Inupiaq person. I did not know what it was like to have a father figure or a mother figure. When I had children, I did not have the tool set that could make a parent. That lasted from when my children were 8 to 18, the years I was at the boarding school. I could only relate to them when they were younger and when they became adults. I passed down to my children their own inabilities to speak their language or know their traditions as well. Some of them have children, and now that I am a grandparent, I can see some of my own grandchildren also not having any idea how to speak their traditional language. Everything I have described happened to thousands and thousands of Alaskan children for generations. You have generations of children each experiencing the same kind of thing at boarding schools. It wasn't just BIA schools, there were also many mission schools. Almost every denomination in Alaska had a boarding school, whether it be Presbyterians, Quakers, Lutherans, Methodists, Moravians, even Baptists. At Wrangell, every fall the school would have the local churches come out to the school, and we were divvied up into a denomination. My mother was a Quaker, but there were no Quakers who came to Wrangell. My brother and I were arbitrarily assigned to the Southern Baptist Church, where we had religious instruction every Wednesday night and every Sunday morning for 6 years. These were federal schools, but yet they had an open-door policy with the local churches. Many times, I was told my mother was a product of the devil because she could speak her language and practice her traditions. I became ashamed of her and never had the chance to apologize to her for that. I have experienced large chunks of missing time in my memory, and many of my classmates became street people or alcoholics and committed horrible crimes they were incarcerated for. Some committed suicide. I have experienced many adverse health effects for my entire life because of poor nutrition and lack of proper health care at boarding schools. I have experienced post-traumatic stress disorder, type 2 diabetes, thyroid illness, shingles, and cataracts. It took many years of learning and therapy to undo the things at boarding school which I thought were normal. This history has been forgotten and washed away. The end. I'm very thankful for Jim LaBelle for letting me share his story. It's so important that people hear his perspective. If you would like to see pictures of the Institute when it was up and running, you can visit Alaska Digital Archives. You can see pictures of the students playing basketball, working on totem poles, and going about their average day. There are also pictures of the Aleut relocation camp, which was set up in front of the Institute in July of 1942. The end. Gunashchish kachu tu yeyakwasatin. Thank you, and see you later.